God and Caesar, Matthew 22:15 through 22, by Robert C. Newman. Let's look first of all at the passage. This is Matthew 22:15 through 22 in the NIV. Then the Pharisees went out and lay plans to trap him in his words, as trap Jesus. They sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, whose portrait is this, and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. When they heard this, they were amazed, so they left him and went away. Well, before we go into the teaching of this passage, we want to look at the background, both the political and religious background of this whole incident. Political background first. About a century before the time of this incident, in 63 BC, Palestine was conquered by Rome, and that ended about 80 years of Jewish independence that had begun with the exciting days of the Maccabees. Following two generations under Jewish client rulers, the last ones being the Herods, in 6 AD, the Romans sent in their own governors. In 30 AD, at the time of Jesus' ministry, this Roman governor was Pontius Pilate. What do we know about Pontius Pilate? Well, a fair bit from the writings of Josephus and from the various Gospels of the New Testament. But according to Josephus in the Bible, Pilate was a rather insensitive ruler. One point in his career after he became governor, he was governor for 10 years, he had tried to bring the Roman army's standards. That was sort of the equivalent at that time of flags. They were poles on which images in bronze, I guess, had been attached. He tried to bring the Roman army standards into Jerusalem, in spite of the fact that they had pagan symbols on them, and the Jews would object, and in fact did object very, very strenuously to this. Later on, Pilate appropriated temple money to build an aqueduct, and although this was partially to the benefit of the temple, bringing water for temple sacrifices and such, Jews did not feel that the Roman governor had any right to lay hands on the temple money. And Pilate also, as governor, had used violence against suspected rebels. That's not too surprising, but even in the temple on one occasion, and that certainly did not go over well with the Jews. Jewish reaction to Roman rule in general varied depending on the person and the diverse Jewish groups, but was generally rather negative, not terribly surprising. The Romans had conquered the country, and although there have certainly been worse rulers in history, they still ran it more or less for their own benefit rather than particularly for the benefit of the people there. Among the Jews, the Sadducees, a group that was the upper crust elite, if you like, that dominated the priesthood, were the most favorable to the Roman rule as they profited from Roman rule. And yet, they would have preferred to rule the country by themselves without the Romans over them, I'm sure. The Herodians, I guess, were next among the groups we know about, though they would have preferred that some member of Herod's family rule as prince or king rather than the Romans ruling, as had been the case from about 30 BC till about 6 AD, and as was the case in Galilee and Perea as well. The Pharisees, which were probably the most influential of these various groups, were anti-Roman, but they were cautious. They were aware of the military power that the Romans had and such, and so they were cautious, if you like. The Zealots, on the other hand, and we don't know how big a group they were, but probably smaller than any of these others, were fiercely anti-Roman, and they became willing after a while to assassinate opponents, whether they be Romans or even collaborating Jews, and they eventually were involved in starting a revolt against Rome in 66 AD, and probably had been involved in some earlier revolts as well. So that was a Jewish reaction to Roman rule. Religious background. Well, a Roman religious background, since the time of Augustus and during Jesus' ministry, we're now in the next emperor, Tiberius, the Roman emperor or his genius, his guiding spirit, had often been worshipped, not in Rome, but in various parts of the Eastern Roman Empire, in which Palestine, Judea was located. Pontius Pilate, as he began his governorship, he had right to mint copper coins. The gold and silver coins were not minted in Palestine. And he had put a picture of the pagan priest's staff, the Litus, on the copper coins that he minted for use in Judea. He did avoid putting human images on the coins, but still, once people realized what this didn't go over too well either. Silver and gold coins, which, as I said, were not minted in Israel, but certainly circulated there, had a picture of the emperor on the front, and this would be the currently ruling emperor, as new coins would drive out the old coins fairly quickly. And then inscriptions on the front and back and other symbols on there were often offensive to the Jews. We give you an example here. And that's the silver denarius, which is the coin that actually comes up in our passage here as well. Here's what the front of the coin looked like, the Tiberius denarius. And on the front, or obverse, as the coin people say, we have a picture of Tiberius with this text in Latin running around the outside, some abbreviations. Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus. So Tiberius was not perhaps claiming divinity himself, but he was claiming to be the son, he was adopted son, of Augustus, who had been declared by the Roman Senate to be divine after his death. So obviously not an inscription that would please the Jews, and even the idea of human images did not go over well with them either. The back of this particular coin, this is not the same coin, but the same denomination and the same period. We have a picture of some figure seated on a throne, and might be the goddess Roma, that is the god who represented the city of Rome. Some have suggested the emperor's wife or mother or something of that sort. Some of you suggested the emperor. Can't really say. I'd say the picture looks somewhat feminine. with the text around the outside, Pontifex Maximus, which has kind of a Roman Catholic sound to us today, that at this time meant the chief priest of the Roman religion. And somewhere along the line, the Bishop of Rome picked up that title. Don't know the exact time of that. But not back here, when Christianity has not yet even gotten rolling. Well, that's a little historical background, and you can see some strong feelings there by the Jews against idolatry and such, and against Roman rule over them and such. We move on then to the actual confrontation that's narrated for us in this passage. And that's this whole matter of paying Roman taxes. The Pharisees are trying to discredit Jesus, and they think they've now devised the perfect plot to discredit Jesus, and that is to ask him whether it is right for them to pay taxes to the Romans, to pay taxes to Caesar. And they think they have him on the horns of a dilemma here. If Jesus says to pay taxes, then they could accuse him of at least tacitly accepting idolatry and Roman rule, since we have this image on the front and back of the coin and the claims of the coin, if you like. And this would ruin his influence with the people. As I say, except for the some of the elite, Roman rule was not particularly popular. On the other hand, if Jesus said not to pay taxes, then the Herodians, which the Pharisees brought along with them, and certainly they didn't get along too well, could accuse Jesus to Pilate, and Pilate could have Jesus executed for sedition, for surely if Jesus said not to pay taxes, anybody taking his advice would be in rebellion against Rome. So there's the perfect trap, if you like. Jesus' response. Well, we can see from our passage that Jesus sees through their plan, and he asks them for a coin of the taxation, and they will give him this denarius. that we saw a picture of above. Probably his opponents will think he is stalling for time to give himself some time to think, so they rush to provide one. But in doing this, they have fallen into Jesus' trap. They inadvertently admit that they are using such coins themselves. So they could hardly accuse Jesus of anything, and notice that in fact Jesus doesn't have a coin. They admit that they're using such coins themselves. From then on, the rest of Jesus' answer will leave them with their argument shot down and with nothing to use to accuse Jesus, either to the people or to the Romans. Well, how does that go? Well, Jesus, first of all, asks them whose picture and inscription is on the coin, and the answer to that is quite obvious, Caesar's. Now, a point that is perhaps not quite so obvious to us today, but would have been quite obvious to them then, as is often seen on coins of this period, the name of the ruler is typically given in the genitive case, so that the coin might have reference to Herod from back a generation earlier or something of that sort, and the genitive case means belonging to so-and-so. So these coins would be understood as belonging to Tiberius Caesar Augustus, if you like. So Jesus tells them to give back to Caesar what belongs to him, and to give back to God what belongs to him. Well, of course, the Old Testament law, the law that the Pharisees were certainly very concerned to uphold, indicated that we have responsibility to give back to something that we borrowed from someone, and responsibility to give it back to its owner. And so here they've got the Roman coins. They have a responsibility to give them back to Caesar. The whole thing of accepting Roman coins means in some sense then that you are accepting the rulership. And yet Jesus doesn't just leave it that way, but he adds this other half, give back to God what belongs to him. And so without climbing out on the limb, he certainly does not, what should we say, warrant that everything that is written on the coin are things that belong to Caesar, that Tiberius is a son of God, or anything of that sort. Huh? Well, that's the response. That carries us into a another section then we'll call the message. What is Jesus teaching when he gives this response into this whole circumstance that we're looking at here? Well, let's think about that a little bit. He gives us two sides. Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and give to God what belongs to God. Give to Caesar. Now, we're not going to chase out everything that the Bible says about this, but we are going to draw in things that Scripture has said elsewhere along these subjects, and we're just going to summarize here. So give to Caesar. Give to Caesar, in their case, or in our case, your government. Give your government the honor that God demands for it, that we have responsibility before God to give our government a certain honor. And unpacking that a little bit, that government has been established by God. You remember Paul deals with this in Romans 12, I believe it is. Your government has been established by God, and it is to receive some of the honor due to God, not any of the honor that God has reserved for himself, but God in some sense has passed on to those in authority, whether they be the father in the family, or whether they be the boss in a business, or whether they be the governor or the emperor in king or president or whatever in a government, they have some honor, and we are to give that honor due to them. Huh? So your government is established by God and is to receive some of the honor that's due to God. Our duty to government is not dependent on how good it is or what it does for us. This is not to say that there's no place where you are not to disobey the government. That's another topic. And I have, in fact, a PowerPoint on that as well. I forgot, the Christian in the State, I think, perhaps, is the title of that PowerPoint. But it does say that we have this responsibility. Here, Jesus says, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And Caesar, at that time, Tiberius, is generally recognized by historians not to have been a great ruler. Not one of the best of the Caesars. Better than Nero, better than Caligula, but not as good as Augustus, and not as good as some of the second century emperors. Our duty to government is not dependent on how good it is. God has established it for certain kinds of purposes. We see a sketch for us in Romans 12. Nor what it does for us. It may, in fact, take more taxes than we would like to give, and it may give back less services than we would like to get. Governments are still established by God. He providentially allows which ones come to pass. We owe to our government the payment of taxes, the showing of respect, and helping to make it better, so much as lies within our power. In some countries, more lies within our power than it does in other countries. Here in the United States, we live in a country in which, let's say, about once a year, we get to be governors for a few minutes when we go into the voting booth and push the various levers or however the technology works for your particular voting area that helps select who's going to do the governing. And we have some other opportunities. We can write letters to our congressmen or write letters to newspapers and such. So there are some things we can do there. That doesn't mean we might not misuse these, but we owe our government the payment of taxes, showing respect, and helping to make it better, so much as lies within our power. Give God. Give God the honor he demands, he deserves. All things come from God, every good and perfect gift. So we owe him everything. We have a responsibility to be thankful. Just the whole matter of justice and recognition of the good that God has done us. We have a responsibility to God in those directions. God doesn't need anything from us, so we can't profit him or earn favor with him. There's no way we can do him a favor, if you like. We can, of course, try to do good deeds that glorify God and such, and we have a responsibility to do those things. But we're not really, in some sense, doing him a favor or doing him something he needs. We are to worship him and not a human ruler. And I think that's part of the thing underlying there. Give back to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and give back to God what belongs to God. Worship does not belong to Caesar. Belongs to God, etc. So there's that hint in Jesus' remark. It's a marvelous soundbite that he could say and do what he did there in just a few seconds, and so marvelously turn back what looked like a perfect trap, and at the same time lay out in a brief statement something that really covers, give us a balanced picture of how we're to interact with God and with government. We were designed to find our real fulfillment in loving and serving God. So honoring and obeying God is totally to our advantage. All things come from him. We owe him everything. Honoring and obeying God is totally to our advantage. Well, gift to Caesar, gift to God. There's something else working in this whole thing, and it's in the exchange, and not so much in Jesus' words, but Jesus' words illustrated, and that is, you can't outsmart God. That's what the Pharisees and Herodians were trying to do with Jesus. And they bombed thoroughly. They were doing something else, too. They were trying to reap the benefits of Roman government without paying taxes, without showing respect, without supporting the ruler. And that certainly is a dishonest and unfair way to behave. They were also acting the same way towards God. Because in acting that way towards one's government, which God has set up, you are, in that way, acting that way toward God, though there were obviously many other ways in which they were trying to reap the benefits of God without showing respect and supporting him, if you like. This all comes home, too. We need to stop and ask ourselves, how do we stand with God and with government? Are we thinking we're going to outsmart God? We're going to be very disappointed one day if we think that. We need to flee to him and realize that he deserves everything we are and have, that we should love him with our heart and mind and soul and strength. And he's provided a way to come to him and to be cleansed from our bad attitudes and our rebellion. And that's through his son, Jesus. We've got plenty about that on the various PowerPoints here on our website as well. Well, that's the end of our brief talk here. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. May it be so.